Ladies and gentlemen, good day, and welcome to today's Copernik Global Investors third quarter 2016 conference call. As a reminder, today's call is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the call over to Neda Jaric, President of the firm. Please go ahead, Neda.
Thank you, Sarah. Good afternoon, and thank you all for joining us. Before I turn it over to Dave Ivan, our CIO and Lead Portfolio Manager, for his commentary on the global all-cap portfolio and thoughts on the market, I would like to briefly update you on our firm. As a firm, we currently manage just north of $2.4 billion in assets under management. At the beginning of the year, we were at approximately $1.6 billion, and at the end of the second quarter, we were at $2.3 billion. This growth has predominantly come from market appreciation, given strong performance, coupled with some positive net flows over the year. Interestingly, we've seen an increased amount of inquiries from large potential clients and consultants. As for our team, we're now 34 people strong, including a new analyst, Todd Tusti, who joined the firm during the third quarter. Todd interned with us last summer while he was getting his MBA from Columbia Business School. Lastly, Dave will be referring to a presentation during the call, and the link of the presentation and the actual presentation can be found on our website, copernikglobal.com, under the News and Views section. Dave, please go ahead, and thank you as always for doing this call.
Okay. Thanks, Neda. Thanks to everybody for dialing in. Things as usual are interesting, although for the quarter, it was not a super eventful quarter in terms of transactions, and we'll get back to that. Thought what I would do is go over some of our slides from the last commentary that generated some interest and from the next commentary we're working on, and go from there and leave a lot of time for question and answer at the end. It's been amazingly 8 years since the first the U.S. and then the whole world really went all in terms of massive deficit spending accompanied by virtually unlimited money printing. The results thus far are mixed. From the standpoint of savers, it's been a disaster, of course. People that spent their whole life saving to have a nest egg now find that their interest rate is zero, and in some cases, less than zero. It also hasn't worked that well in terms of economic growth, and it has not created a whole lot in the way of meaningful jobs. It has succeeded in one of their primary goals, and that is to boost the price of assets across the board, whether it's bonds or stocks or high-end real estate or art or you name it. Prices are much, much higher than they were 8 years ago, so they have succeeded there. Looking at all, what does it mean? From my standpoint, I went back to the internet to see if they still teach economics the way they taught it back in the late '70s. Pulled this question off. At least on this one, the answer is the same as it was back then. The answer is A. Really, economics is all about scarcity. This is now an interesting world where people don't seem to care about scarcity anymore. Matter of fact, it's inverse. It's the more money they print, the more the dollar went up when they were printing dollars. The euro went up when they were printing euros. The yen had a nice bounce while they were printing a lot of yen, and so on and so forth. As the quantity of bonds around the world grows at an exponential rate, it's amazing to see the price of bonds go to all-time highs, the highest in the history of mankind. Fascinating. Anyhow, continuing on the subject of economics, we are often thought to be an unconventional firm, and we're fine with that. When I go back and look at it, the things we're doing that are so unconventional are the things that for centuries really were conventional. I think for centuries, people believed that supply and demand were important, that scarcity matters, that bonds should really be priced based on not some uttering of the Fed or not some CPI number, but by the ability of the borrower to pay you back and the willingness of the buyer to pay you back. Now it seems quaint, I guess. We were taught valuation matters, that paying above intrinsic value is a speculative idea. and so on and so forth. Incentives, we think part of economics is people do respond to incentives. So we think early, maybe we're not the unconventional one, maybe society's become somewhat unconventional. But of all the premises on there, one of them is that there is no free lunch, and there are consequences, often unintended consequences of government action and any other action. So what happens when you print too much money? Where does it go? Well, in the early 1700s, they printed a lot of money in France under John Law's guidance. The money went into the Mississippi Company, created quite a bubble. England, not to be left behind, had the South Seas Company, experienced several similar bubbles. And in 1929, in the U.S., we had blind pools. We had all kinds of speculation in stocks, Japanese real estate in the late 80s, and stocks for that matter, something that many of us still remember. 1999, when they printed a lot of money, they printed money in response to the Asia crisis and the Russia crisis and the long-term capital crisis, and they printed money for the Y2K non-crisis. It all led to a spectacular bubble in the index. At TMT, of course, but also the index. Passive investing became crazy. The next 7 years were very, very good times for active managers. This chart shows that the last 10 years or 9 years have once again been not so good for active managers. We've talked in the past as a cyclical phenomenon. There's good and bad things about ETFs and index funds, and I think a little bit of it is a good thing. Too much of anything can become a bad thing. Right now, there's been a lot of years of money increasingly going into highly liquid stocks that can be held by ETFs as the money's come away from active managers, forcing them to sell companies, whether they're good or bad or high-priced or low-priced, they're being forced sales. This is the exact thing that created an incredible opportunity 16 years ago in the markets. We think that's the case again. Anyhow, when I was speaking at the London Value Conference, I was impressed with a presentation by a guy named Michael Keller that had a lot of great slides on ETFs and passive investing in general, and points out that that there are some great things. It's obvious what's not to like about low cost, low turnover, minimal tracking error, tax advantages, liquidity, less fees. All other things being equal, ETFs are a real good thing. But like I say, there is no free lunch. There's a cost to everything. What does one give up for these advantages? Well, they really give up efficiencies. They give up active analysis. Pretty much the money flows into the recent winners. I would say true investors, if something gets more expensive, they like it less. And as it drops in price and prospective returns become higher, they like it more. Passive investing, of course, works the opposite. If a stock doubles and becomes twice as high a percentage of an index, twice as high a percentage of the ETF, that means all new money is now buying twice as much of the now more expensive stock. That's an aberration. And it's something that when you think about it, doesn't make a lot of sense. The redemptions, of course, from active managers, they force wholesale sales of things that might be very attractive. Index compositions done by a third party. The third parties, if you talk to them, won't even profess to do analysis. They don't claim that we've analyzed these things. They don't say that we've valued these things. That's not their goal, to pick the best investments. So for people to rush in to buy things that were not even meant to be good investments is a weird thing. But at the very least, the assumptions that underlie the efficient market hypothesis are nullified once too many people start using active investments. Just like 99, so many people are using passive investments right now that it's quite likely gone too far. If you look at the valuations of the ETFs versus the valuations of the non-components of ETFs, it's really extreme, and so we think that bodes well. So basically, this slide, he points out in his presentation that little attention is paid to divergences between market value and intrinsic value. Now, that's what Kopernik does for a living. We do pay attention to divergences between market value and intrinsic value. And when the market's not paying attention, that allows the gap between what something's worth and what the market's pricing becomes very, very big. So this is actually nirvana for active investors, the fact that this trend has gone as far as it has. So he points out, we agree, value-oriented investors with a full-cycle mindset can benefit. We think that's the case. Contextual awareness of form of risk management would be quite valuable. We agree with that. So there are times when passive investing is a good thing. Certainly it has been the last 8 or 9 years. But we think it won't be going forward, just like the last time it was very popular. So that's one unintended consequence of easy money. It goes into stocks that might otherwise be fine, but they get to too high a price. Keeping along that case, ETF proponents in general become too expensive. Popular industries, popular sectors, but popular countries can become too expensive. Popular regions can become too expensive. Certainly, 6-7 years ago, we saw emerging markets become kind of expensive. Now we're at the other end, where emerging markets are arguably too cheap, and the U.S. has become quite expensive. It's fine for money to go into the U.S. There's a lot of things to like about the U.S. We have no problems with the U.S. We have a problem when 20% of the world's GDP is capitalized at 54% of the world's market capitalization, judging by the all-country world index. This seems to be an accident waiting to happen. To further explore that, not only is 54% of the money in one country, 9% of the entire capitalization is in a mere 10 companies, 9 of which, of course, are in the U.S. That's a potential problem. The valuations, a PE of 17.5 is not outrageous. It's aggressive, but not outrageous. 17.5 PE on margins that in generally are twice normal, that's pretty scary. So that's something people should keep their eye on. But the other side of the story is, look at how little money now is in telecom. I think a lot of us can remember 1999 when people were willing to pay almost infinity for telecom. Now it's a small part of the index. Real estate, 2007 wasn't that long ago when people really loved real estate. So there are opportunities. And so with that, let's put all the negatives behind us and let's look at the positives. Yeah, the positives are we've seen this story before. We know how it is. I often like to take movies and songs and things and roll them the theme. Somehow I see an investment message in everything. I'm a fan of most movies that Bill Murray's done and certainly Groundhog Day. So we're trying to weave that into our next commentary. But the whole idea is the central bank says they're trying new things, things that have never been tried before. Now they've been tried hundreds of times. Yeah, it ends up the same way. It ends up with goosing assets to high prices, but only the popular assets. It leaves a lot of other things behind. So now let's go back and look at the last slide we were looking at, but throwing our current portfolio in there. you can see it looks a lot different than the index. So if the world wants to capitalize one country at 54% and then take most of the world's population and over half the GDP and most of the growth and a lot of the resources and you name it and capitalize that at 10%. So over half the world's GDP at 10% of market cap, and of course I'm talking emerging markets, what a beautiful thing. There's been a little bit of a bounce in material stocks. It's just a little dent into the drop of the previous 6 years. They're still very cheap. Here in Canada, is expressing a lot of the opportunities and resources. We can come back to that. Really, the market's selling the fastest growth areas of the world for the lowest prices. They're taking some big industries and selling them for next to nothing, overcapitalizing other things. It's not a market where somebody needs to be a deep value investor and go for the number 7 player in an industry or the number 14 player in an industry and hope things turn around. This is a market where if the market doesn't think it's popular, you can buy duopolis, oligopolis, monopolis in really good areas, areas that will be good 5 years from now, 10 years from now, and buy them at discounts. So this portfolio shows the number one uranium company. We'll come back to you. We have 3 of the top 5 gold companies, the largest gas company, the largest nuclear power company, some of the largest global trading companies, one of the larger, most profitable emerging market banks, the 2 largest hydroelectric franchises, and so on. These are the companies that are now selling at 11 times earnings and a fraction of book value. That's a pretty fascinating thing. Now, things went into a long bear market. I think we talked last winter about how a lot of things have been in a bear market for since 07 in some cases, and at least 4 or 5 or 6 years in other cases, but long drawn out bear market. And now some things have bounced back. The things that have bounced back big, we appreciate that, but they only got back to where they were a couple of years ago. We think there's a lot of room. But rather than talk about the things that have gone up, let's talk about some of the things that haven't gone up. Interesting enough, the fundamentals for gold and coal and oil and gas and copper, you name it, reasonably good. Fundamentals for uranium, absolutely compelling. A half year ago, a year ago, we were more bullish on uranium than anything else, and why everything else has gone up, uranium has gone down. We were flabbergasted when the price of something falls from 150 down to 36. It seemed unreal. Then it fell to 26. That seemed like it couldn't possibly go lower. Today it went under 20. We're possibly wrong. That's always a possibility. The fundamentals argue otherwise. The fundamentals argue strongly that this is one of the best places in the world to be invested. That simple supply and demand. If we're going to need uranium, they're going to need to pull it out of mines. Nobody's building mines. Nobody will build mines unless the price almost quadruples from where it is now. We're in an era of 0% interest rates, and here's something that arguably could quadruple. Timing, not our forte. And so we'll see. But we do know that there are a lot of nuclear power plants in the world. We do know some will come offline. We know most of the Japanese ones have come offline. The German ones probably will. We also know that a lot of the Japanese ones probably come back online. And we know that they're building 80 new power plants around the world, 60 in China alone. If you assume even half of those actually go through and get finished, that's a lot of new demand. And we don't have enough uranium to meet the uranium supply to meet the demand of the existing plants. So supply arguably is well short of demand. Those of you who have been listening, I've been saying this for a few years, so that hasn't stopped the price from dropping. But in the long run, commodities always get back to their incremental cost of future production. It's just a matter of when. So we like that. We continue to view Cameco, who's the world leader, as one of our favorite names. We've also been able to add a couple of the junior ones, Denison and Fission, that have finally come into price ranges that we're comfortable with. So that we feel pretty good about. Outside of that, 6 months ago, I did what I haven't done in my 35-year career, and that was show people that we had stocks that I thought could go double, triple, up five times even. It's something we, like I say, haven't ever done. Probably seemed outrageous. Since then, a lot of our gold mining stocks and our emerging market stocks are up two, three, even five times. So that part's happened. So we've toned it down. Instead of saying two times, three times, five times, we still think from current valuations that doubles a reasonable assumption, that we're showing 50%, 100%, 150%. Once again, timing's not our forte. It turned out to be beautiful timing in terms of oil, gas, coal, gold, and miserable timing on uranium. We do think there's good potential. Once again, we don't know the timing. We don't know if we wait a month or 2 years. This shows that even if we have to wait 10 years to be right on some of these things, it beats the heck out of what the bond market's offering and probably what the major indexes are offering. So we believe when that kind of potential is there that we agree with Warren Buffett's quote on the last page: the stock market is a device for transferring money from the impatient to the patient. There's a lot of impatience in the world. We think we can be very patient, especially for those kind of returns. So that's where we are now. I mentioned there's not a lot of activity in the quarter, but in general we did add to the uranium positions. We mentioned that. We were able to add to some good positions in Asia, because Asia is quite well lagged, so we were able to increase positions in Korean autos and agriculture and Indonesia, railroads in China, and trading companies in Japan, and so on and so forth. And then, of course, there are a lot of decreases in the gold, the coal, the U.S. airline, the emerging market names that did have such a big run. We've consistently trimmed those, but still see a lot of upside from here. So, as I said, I'd like to leave most of the time for Q&A, so let's pause here.
Thank you. To the audience, if you have a question or comment today, please press star then one on your touch-tone phone. For those of you joining us today using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, to the audience, please press star then one if you have a question or comment today. We'll go first to Andrea Zilli of Merrill Lynch.
Hey, Dave. How are you? Thank you for taking the time.
Good. How are you?
Good, thanks. I was wondering if you can expand on Cameco and particularly touching on the staying power of the company while the uranium market recovers.
Yeah, that's actually one of the good things about Cameco. It's a big, stable company, a lot of market share. It was once part of the Canadian government. It's got a lot of resources. Doesn't have that much debt. They do have a contingent liability. Like a lot of companies in the world now, the governments are looking at transfer pricing, and did you try to avoid taxation in Canada by making the profits happen elsewhere? So whether that gets resolved at no cost to them or more likely $600 million, some people think it could be $1 or $2 billion, even under a worst-case scenario, they are in no problem financially. They're a profitable company. They have lots of long-term contracts. The long-term contracts do mean that when the price does go screaming up, that their profits will go up a lot slower. But it also means that they're continuing to make really good money now, even though the price has been falling for years. So, they won't be as high beta as they could be to the price of uranium, but they're very financially strong and way stronger than anybody else in the business. So, that has lots of staying power, and we feel very good about it.
Thank you.
Up next from Royal Bank of Canada, we'll go to Lance Newman.
Hey, Dave. Thanks for taking my question. Do we need to think of this portfolio, do we need a weak dollar in order for it to go much higher, or is the dollar something that we can not obsess over?
Yeah, our view, if you look back at the page, I went back to it, when you have a portfolio that's 11 times earnings and less than 5 times cash flow and a 25% discount to a very solid book value, companies that really meet the needs of the emerging economy around the world, the people in the growing parts of the world that can all of a sudden afford electricity and cell phones and railroad transportation and you name it. I believe that good economy, bad economy, high inflation, low inflation, weak dollar, strong dollar, these valuations for these kind of companies should lead to really nice returns. So I don't think the dollar over the long run should matter that much. It is true that the strong dollar in the last 4 or 5 years has lowered our returns. And if the dollar were to be weak and or inflation become much more visible, then I think good returns become great returns. But we have not designed this as a dollar play. We have just 100% bottom up looked for good companies at good prices, and it's just lucky aside that they are companies that will benefit when fiat currencies inevitably do fall, but that is not the way the portfolio is built.
Perfect. I had a feeling you were going to say that, but I appreciate you backing me up.
All right.
Is there anything further, caller?
No, thanks.
Okay, thank you. Up next from Aubrey Sharfman, Morgan Stanley is our next question.
Hey, Dave, thanks for always the great responsiveness and thanks for the great year. Broadening on the earlier questioner who asked about the staying power for Cameco, could you speak to that same question but address it with some of these smaller companies like Uranium Participation, Denison, Fission Uranium, et cetera?
Yeah. Uranium Participation also is unlimited staying power, really, because all it is a corporation, but it should be considered more of a ETF that holds uranium. All it does is hold uranium. And, yeah, so that staying power is not a problem. The other ones, yes, right now they own a bunch of uranium. They have no ability to get the uranium. It would cost them a lot of money to build out mines. This is similar to some of our junior gold companies. So if these junior gold companies or these junior uranium companies decided right now that they want to build their mines, we would fight them with everything we have. We think that uranium and gold are very good things that, if the market's right, are worth where they are now, but if economics still means anything, the price is going to go way higher. So the optionality is worth a lot. So why somebody would spend a lot of money to pull uranium out of the ground today and sell it for $20 when they quite likely can get $80 if they're just willing to wait 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years, whatever, You know, their balance sheets are not a problem at all. It would be whether they decide to destroy their balance sheet and or dilute the equity holders in order to raise the money to build a mine. Now, most people would view it as a negative that these gold and uranium companies can't build the mine now. We view it as a positive. We don't want them building mines. We think we have massive optionality that we haven't had to pay anything for. And so, so no lack of staying power, but inability to develop a mine at these levels.
Speaking towards your management point about them not having the ability right now, I know in the past we've talked about how many of the gold miners, there's a wide discrepancy in terms of the quality of management company by company. How do you feel about the quality of management for some of these smaller uranium companies to be able to make thoughtful decisions like this?
Yeah, I think they're probably better than a lot of the gold companies, but so let's say neutral on management there. On the gold companies, some were positive, but a lot were pretty negative. But to go off on a tangent, which I often don't need to do, when you look at mining companies, I think the positives are real, that they have something scarce, something that's hard to find, something that can't be replicated, something that's going to hold its value in real terms and quite likely increase their value immensely in nominal terms. That's the positives. The negatives are also real. The negatives are management teams don't always do what we'd like them to do, sometimes destroying a lot of wealth. Governments are making it harder to mine, whether it's like Cameco, where they're coming after them for tax, or other ones where they're having to pay higher royalties to the governments. Cost of mining continues to go up. Geology and geography and chemistry and all these things become problems. And so there are, you know, while there's very little risk, in our opinion, to gold and uranium, there's very high risk to gold and uranium mining companies, but also what they taught me in school way back when, you can diversify out business risk, and so we try to do several things. We do try to buy the best managements and the biggest reserves and the ones that we think have the biggest chance of success, and we try to buy them at huge discounts to what we think they are worth intrinsically, and we diversify. So we wouldn't want to have all our money in one of these little uranium companies or all our money in one gold company. We love having a diversified portfolio of some of the greatest properties in the world for gold and uranium, and we have it diversified across managements, across geographies, across regulatory things, and across currencies. And so we think that a portfolio of volatile things on their own can actually be less volatile and very low risk on a portfolio basis. So that's our prognosis.
Thanks so much. Much appreciated.
We'll go next to Gary Magnuson of Morgan Stanley.
Hi, Dave. Hey, I was wondering if you had any data about nuclear plants in terms of, like, each year, how many are coming online and how many are going offline and kind of what the net number of plants each year is. It, how does that look to you? And then a question sort of tied to that, when uranium is produced, what percent goes to nuclear plants and about what percent goes elsewhere? I suppose medical and manufacturing or something, but was curious if you had anything.
And the vast bulk of it goes to nuclear plants. We can try to come up with a number, the vast bulk. Although, interesting enough, it is a very small part of the cost of producing electricity from nuclear power. The capital costs are huge. The fuel costs are about 3%. Numbers from what plants are getting, what Cameco has that stuff on their website. There's several books that have it. Maybe we should see if we can update that on the website or send it to you later. Yeah, we certainly should put a white paper or something on this subject. It comes up a lot, so that is one thing we're working on. The last numbers I saw was about 80 that are at various stages around the world, 60 of which were China. You know, there's even one in the U.S. and in the U.K. that has the go-ahead again. There's in Arabia, there's some. India, I think, 4. But we can dig all that up.
And how long does it take these days? I imagine it depends on the country to build one.
It depends on the country. It depends on a lot of things. And invariably, it takes more time and money than people expect, which is one of the big drawbacks. And so we do think that most of these will get built, but they are taking longer and probably will continue to take longer. So the schedule from 2 years ago is a little different than the schedule from most recent that we've seen. These things have been pushed out a bit.
Is there anything further, Mr. Magnuson?
No, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Up next, we have Mark Johnson of RBF Wealth Advisors.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for hosting this call. And I might be ignorant on this, but maybe there's another person on the line that could benefit as well. What happened to the price of uranium and, I guess, coal as well? Coal has had a nice bounce, but, I mean, was it just political stuff that drove down the price? Obviously, it doesn't appear that demand has declined for either coal or uranium, or am I wrong on that point?
Yeah, I mean, it's a point where maybe it's not easy to have a single right answer, but sort of both the last commentary and what I've been saying now, when you print a lot of money out of thin air, there's unintended consequences sometimes, and there is so much money sloshing around the world right now. The money supply in the U.S. quintupled in the last decade, and Japanese are trying to put us to shame now, and every place else seems to be printing now. At some point, the tail wags the dog. And so in the long run, Buffett's right, the market's, in the short run, a voting machine, in the long run, a weighing machine. But when all this money's printed, it really accentuates those short-term problems. So when there's massive money out there and everybody says, time to hate coal, wow, massive money shorting coal and everybody pulling away, and the markets tend to be much more momentum. And people change their mind from 6 years ago saying China's going to grow 10% a year forever, which, of course, is mathematically impossible. But they all believed that, and they ran the price of coal to obscene prices. And so they came down big, as they ought to. And once they got to a more reasonable price, they kept going and kept going and kept going and kept going. And it's really pretty crazy, I think, where prices of coal got to. People were actually believing that we weren't going to use coal anymore. The market share is falling. The market's going to keep falling. It certainly should keep falling. Who wouldn't prefer solar and wind and stuff to coal? But there are 7.3 billion on the planet. It's funny, I just came back from a trip around Asia. I went to Pakistan, and they were talking how they couldn't wait to develop their coal, that it was going to make them not dependent on foreign economies, and they have all this coal. I went to Bangladesh, they were going to develop our coal. Went to Vietnam, they're saying, we need to develop more of our coal. I mean, people couldn't wait to build. Indonesia, I didn't go to this time, but they're building plants, they want to use more coal. Coal has problems. It's going to lose share. Its future is less robust than the past, but the market got to really crazy low levels, I think. That's also the case in most every commodity. They all have good things about them. They all have bad things about them, and they were all, many of them, coming off too high prices years ago. But the prices things got to last winter had no relation whatsoever with the intrinsic value. in our opinion. Now they've bounced back. But so everything's going up now except for uranium, which keeps going down. I wish I had an answer for you on why it's going down, but somebody's driving it down for some reason.
It's not a demand issue. There's not less uranium being used today than there was 2 years ago or 3 years ago.
If you look at demand side, it's been good for a lot of years. Then 3-4 years back, you had, or how long longer now, I guess, five years or whatever, the Fukushima, that took demand off pretty quickly. And then the economy slowed down, which slows growth. So demand fell then. That was then, not now. Now demand is okay. The supply side was the big problem. The supply side was a couple of years ago, you had the utilities that were shut down. Rumor is that some of them were selling their inventory into a weak market. We know the Department of Energy keeps selling their inventories into a weak market. For 20 years, the Russians were dumping a bunch of uranium onto the market per contract under the megatons to megawatt program, where their bombs were being turned into fuel. And the price plunging down into below 30, a lot of that was just the excess supply. The Russian program's done. I'm not aware of any increase in the DOE, and they're going to run out sooner or later. And I'm not aware of any bales dumping inventories. I cannot explain this drop. It feels a lot like what was happening to gold and copper and coal and oil 8 months ago when oil was 28. Somebody's pounding it for some reason. We always say when the market price differs from the fundamentals by a long period, we're going to take advantage of that. We'll be wrong sometimes, but almost always economics wins out. And certainly the upside is big. What's it going to fall, $20 more from here? Uranium is important, valuable, costs $75, $80 to bring on incremental supply. So I cannot explain short-term trades. I have never been good at explaining short-term trades. We've always tried to be good at taking advantage of short-term aberrations, and that's how we view this. Time will tell.
Thank you.
We'll move next to Sean Purdy of Morgan Stanley. Please go ahead.
Hey, Dave. I wondered if you and you or your team have any thoughts or have looked at UEC, Uranium Energy Corp.
Yeah, no, we've met with them, and some of our people know them. And now that the smaller guys have gotten into, now that they've been falling into those downdrafts, maybe whether it's that one or a couple of the other ones, maybe we do add a few more of them. But, they have an interesting model. They have a different model. But we don't have any research complete, and there's not a lot I want to say publicly on that.
Okay. And thanks for all the insights. And I notice you're increasing the number that you put up there each year. I enjoy reading.
Oh, thanks.
And once again to the audience, it is star then one for questions. Up next from Battery Global Advisors, we'll go to Matya Schachter.
I guess I was hoping you could talk about the possibility that utilities are overbuilding on their electricity production relative to demand given energy efficiency and other aspects of what's been going on the regulatory side, and if so, how that would play out vis-a-vis your nuclear thesis?
Yeah. Electricity is interesting. It's regional, of course. Right now we don't own anything in the States, where returns are still pretty high, but quite likely can be vulnerable to regulatory down pressure. Have solar where solar is makes sense. Solar should be laid out where there's a lot of sun, and wind should be used where there's a lot of wind, and you know, coal should probably be only used where they don't have a lot of that. And then, of course, there's base power and there's peaking power. How much is being built and needs to be built, and how much the whole distributed electricity model works for the future versus how much it can be undermined by battery power. And it is unknown. So it's quite possible people are overbuilding in some areas of the world. It's also possible that we'll get to where we were 6 years ago, where people start clamoring for enough energy, especially in growth economies, when Brazil didn't allow returns on the investment. There starts to be blackouts and brownouts, and then people start wishing there's more. Our view is that if you have enough rainfall and you have hydro dams, that there's really nothing better. If you have a nuclear plant and it's built, there's very little that's better. And those should both be run baseline all the time. The variable cost is next to nothing, and there's virtually no pollution. So we don't see a lot of risk from that standpoint. There's other risks to some of the stocks we own, but we don't see a risk of them being disintermediated. Should there be overbuilding, what's going to get disintermediated? If you look at coal, newer coal plants are pretty efficient. Older coal plants are not efficient, and they're very polluting, and they should be shut down. You've seen even when electricity demand was good over the last 30 years, you've seen heating oil all but disappear from the market. And so we think you'll continue to see solar, we'll continue to see wind, maybe you'll see conservation. But if it's older building, it's a threat to high-cost plants, and we've tried to avoid high-cost plants. And with the exception of EDF, we've tried to concentrate on growing areas of the world where the problem's more likely going to be not enough electricity versus overbuilding of electricity. But it is regional, and there's a lot of things to consider, and it's a very good question you ask.
Can you talk to the Exelon closing the two plants in Illinois and how that's related, given your comment that once the plant is built, these things should be up and running for extended periods of time?
Yeah, no, I can talk to our analysts, and I saw the news, but I haven't looked in depth. But if a plant's up, you generally want to keep running it as long as you can. However, if a plant gets old enough, you have to put a whole lot of new money in it at various times. I know on EDF we've been very conservative on our assumption on how much money they're going to have to put into keeping those things running. Now, whether Exelon was doing it because of politics or because it was going to cost them too much to keep the things going, I'll have to look into that. Like I say, it's been, back 6-7 years ago, we owned a lot of U.S. utilities, including Exelon, but they've all been out of our price range for quite a while, so I haven't really paid a lot of attention, so I'll have to take a look.
Are labor costs a significant aspect of the business there, or is that also pretty low in addition to the low fuel cost?
Yeah, last I looked, it's not that big. Capital costs are very important, which also adds to the interest of analyzing plants, because a lot of people like to come up with their own views, or let's not say their own, let's say academic views on what a cost of capital is. And there's all kinds of different assumptions on what a cost of capital should be for a nuclear power plant. And if you assume high betas and high risk and high cost of capital, then it's hard to make the case. But if you just say how much money was actually spent and how much cash are we allowed to generate, usually they're pretty good businesses. But capital, far and away, is the biggest cost.
Okay, thank you.
Up next from J.P. Morgan, we'll hear from Stefan Roth.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for a good call. Two questions, really. One is, for your existing gold miners exposure, what does the price of gold have to trade at for them to be profitable? And then for your existing uranium miners, what does the price of uranium have to trade at? What is the price of uranium today for those companies to be profitable? Thanks.
Yeah, sure. A more complicated question than it might sound. Most of our gold companies, if they just cash flowed out, if they just pulled out of the ground and sold it and closed their doors, we think most of them are worth a little more than they're selling it. So on a just cash on cash return, they're already profitable at current gold costs. So we look at that just in terms of what's our margin of safety, what's the likelihood that we lose money from where we are now. So that gives us a lot of confidence. But profitability is a fascinating thing. If they pull it out of the ground and sell it and they subtract their historic costs, they are profitable. As ongoing businesses, if you're going to pull gold out of the ground or uranium out of the ground, you should go replace that. You need to go find a new mine and permit the new mine and build the new mine and come up with agreements on tax and royalty and all these things. And we believe that in general it takes $2,000 to would be the cost of building a new significant gold mine. We think $75 or more is what it would cost to build a meaningful uranium. I mean, UEC was brought up, they could do it a lot cheaper, but not meaningful amounts. So meaningful amounts to replace what you're pulling out would be $75. And so we think that the price probably gets to $75. I mean, the price of gold quite likely gets to $2,000. And then we say to ourselves, how much money do we make or lose if we're just wrong and prices stay where they are now? And we think we actually make a little money if they stay where they are now. If they get back to the incentive price, then we have huge upside because, one, the optionality we have, two, people will start to value these as going concerns and put big multiples out on the future. And so, we see very little downside, lots of upside. The little uranium guys are kind of the same. Cameco's a bit different, as I mentioned earlier. Cameco, they're not selling much uranium at $20. They're selling it at $30 and $40 and $50 under long-term contracts. And so, if prices stayed down for a long time, you'd slowly see their profits start to drop, and if price shoot back, you'll slowly start to see their profitability grow up. So that's much more stable. They're pretty nicely profitable today. But yes, in the long term, the price needs to go much higher, otherwise they'll slowly,
Is uranium price been, as you indicated, so it's trading in the $20 range, but Cameco has these long-term contracts, it's a 30-40?
Yeah.
If I understood correctly. Okay.
Yeah, and 20 years ago, uranium got down to under $10. Then it got as high as roughly $140. And both of those prices proved to be unsustainable. I think 20 now is equally as ridiculous as $10 20 years ago. Like I say, the cost of production of building a meaningful mine is way, way higher. So, a year ago, I would have told you it's all but impossible to see 20, so much for my credibility. But I will say it cannot stay here for a meaningful period of time.
I appreciate it. One more question while I got you on the line. Any thoughts about the developments going on in Europe, particularly the banking situation in Italy and its potential impact on any exposure you may have? indirectly?
Yeah, we own only one bank, that's Sberbank in Russia. If you look historically, I think from 2003 through 2008, we owned no financials to speak of, no banks. It was something that came up a lot. Then in 2009, we did buy one European bank, but we mostly bought emerging market banks. We bought banks in India and Thailand and Russia, and you know, those all worked out really well. But the reason I'm pointing all that out is we like banks. We like a lot of things about banks. We dislike certain things about banks. We dislike the huge supply of banks around the world. We dislike the supply of what they do, and i.e., debt as a percent of the worldwide economy is at levels that have never been seen in history. Therefore, there's too much to supply. If we're looking at a copper company and there was just inventories of copper piled up around the world, people would worry about it. So we worry about that. We worry about them being pretty much 90% debt to assets. And when you dig in on what their equity really is, sometimes it's worse than that. And so when you put it all together, we have lower degree of confidence. And I have a higher degree of confidence that the price of uranium will go up to its intrinsic value than that I understand the balance sheet of Deutsche Bank. And so we think Deutsche Bank's arguably cheap. The U.S. banks are arguably cheap. The Italian banks are really cheap. The Chinese banks are really, really cheap. We probably won't buy any of them because we probably need to see them at an 80% discount to what we think they're worth. We might buy some of the British banks. We might buy some of the Korean banks. We might buy some of the Japanese banks. Some of the banks that are, you know, maybe less exciting, but it's easier for us to understand their balance sheets. And so we like banks, but we don't have enough confidence to pay anywhere near a fair price. We want our cake and eat it too. We want really big discounts. And so I don't know if that's much of an answer. We just try to know what our strengths and our weaknesses are, and it's really hard to analyze a bank.
Well, I appreciate the comments, and keep up the good work. Thank you.
Morgan Stanley's Dave Oscar has our next question. Please go ahead.
Dave, I just wondered if you would, touch base on Arch Coal and then coming out of bankruptcy. I know that was a position you had at one time, and what your thoughts are today.
Yeah. Arch Coal, a couple of years back, we decided that on a risk-return basis that Arch seemed riskier than Peabody. So we went out of the frying pan into the fire or whatever. We've been out of Arch for a long, long time, so we haven't really stayed on top of that. Peabody, we colossally lost a lot of money on. We thought, and we continue to believe, that Peabody has assets that are worth way, way more than their liabilities. The market has a different opinion. None of that really matters. What matters is management decided to file for bankruptcy at the bottom. I mean, they nailed it. They bought properties in Australia at the top, and they filed for bankruptcy at the bottom. Now there's speculation. Maybe something will happen. We have no idea. Status quo is they'll eventually be worth zero. And if somebody can make something happen, then maybe it's worth a lot. We don't know. But Arch and Peabody and a whole lot of others, they took on debt at an inappropriate time, and they filed for bankruptcy at probably the wrong time also. As I said earlier, we think that coal is not that great, but it's way better than what the market thought it was a year ago. It's not going away. We see a lot of value in some of these stocks that, like I say, it's been a couple of years since we actually owned Arch, so I can't give you a real good answer on that one.
Okay, thank you.
Shannon Quinn of Merrill Lynch has our next question. Please go ahead.
Hey, Dave. Do you guys add any non-equity securities to the portfolio this year? And going forward, do you have any plans to do that, make any, like, debt for equity swaps or anything like that out of any of your holdings?
Yeah, we don't do debt equity swaps. Historically, we've been happy to use bonds when we think we can get equity-like returns. So we have a lot of bonds, busted convertibles and things in 2003 and also in 2008. With interest rates at zero, it makes it harder to find the really good opportunities. So not really, with the exception of there's Gabriel, which is a gold company where we were really in a good position to fund them with a bond and later had the option to increase that bond when it was already based on the converted price worth twice what we were buying the bond at. So we have a pretty big position in that one. That was just sort of an advantageous position we found ourselves in, and so that was the best of both worlds. We're buying stock at less than the stock was worth with the safety of a bond. Yeah, we view ourselves as appraisers of securities and businesses. We're trying to buy things at less than they're worth, and if we can buy a bond at a way better value than the associated stock is, we're happy to do that. But the world central banks have made that much harder to do, so not likely to see a lot of that until the next meltdown, whatever that is.
Thanks.
Harry Magnuson of Morgan Stanley has our next question.
Yeah, Dave, I just had a follow-up. You mentioned that you had bought some trading companies, and I assume it was like Mitsubishi you showed and Mitsui. I guess those are trading companies. Can you tell us a little bit about trading companies and why they're undervalued? I assume maybe the yen had something to do with those, or maybe that's not the ones you want to talk about. If you could just fill us in on that area, that'd be great. And then how much cash do you have left to buy stuff?
Yeah. Those are the two. They both big companies that have been around a long time that are very global in nature. The question came up earlier on banks. So if you take the pros and cons of banks and apply to these companies, they half applied. They're kind of bank-like. More merchant bank-like. So they trade and they buy and they sell, but they also end up owning properties in various places around the world. What you had earlier in the year was sort of a perfect, well, let's say perfect negative situation, but from an investor standpoint, a perfect situation. People hated Japan, they hated the yen, they hated banks, and they really, really hated natural resources of all kinds. And so how about a Japanese company that's yen-based, that has properties and exposure to natural resources all around the world? People couldn't hate them more. And then you take these companies that for half a century have never lost money, and then you throw in some write-offs, and you know, what's the like, I guess. So we say, well, here's companies that really have done great for half a century, and they own resources, and resources are underpriced, and they pretty consistently make a lot of money with the one exception. So to be able to buy franchises that own good properties around the world, the currencies are, I won't get into it a lot now, we spend tons of time on currencies here, but if you're in a resource business or an ag business or a trading business or a resource business, the currency of domicile doesn't matter that much. So I think people were too afraid of the yen and way too afraid of resources and looking in the rearview mirror, So we were able to buy world-class franchises at nice discounts to book value and 5-6 times normalized earnings. Good businesses, but a little more difficult to analyze than Johnson & Johnson.
And how much cash would you have if you wanted to buy in April or something like that?
Yeah, our cash tends to fluctuate between 0 and 10%. It sort of goes up and down as we're finding more or less things to buy. In February, our cash was pretty much down to zero as we were finding a lot of things. But 6% is where it is now. So we have cash if a few things want to get hit here.
Thanks.
And as a final reminder to our audience today, it is star then one if you have a question or comment. We'll pause for just a moment. And it appears there are no further questions at this time. I would like to turn the conference back over to our speakers for any additional or closing remarks.
Okay. Well, a lot of good questions, and we definitely appreciate everybody's support. Thank you very much. We'll talk to you in 3 months.
And that does conclude today's conference. We thank you all for joining.